Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about anomalies, legends, and monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove.
I'm Mark Matzke. Happy New Year to all of you.
Yeah.
And especially you, Seth.
Yeah. This is our first time recording together in the new year.
Yes.
Big response on the last slew of episodes. The last, like, all the Christmassy, winter-timey.
The Yuletide, Yuletide carols.
Sorry, listeners, if there's a weird noise, it's just me fixing my microphone. She's on a funky stand that doesn't want to cooperate. So this week, we are talking about airships. I blacked out. I actually passed out.
You had some missing time.
Yeah. When Mark got here today, I had just finished recording the first, I guess all six episodes worth of narration for our upcoming On the Trail of Bigfoot miniseries from Small Town Monsters. I said that because this is a Small Town Monsters podcast, not because this is just one big ad. Let's face it.
It's the official, isn't it? It's the official
podcast of Small Town Monsters.
Yeah.
So
unlike all those unofficial.
There's a lot out there. Yes.
Podcasts.
Make sure you're only listening to the official Small Town Monsters podcast, not the fake ones or the fan cast. If you guys want to make my year, go start a fan cast of Small Town Monsters, some sort of Small Town Monsters fan cast, and it'll make my year, unless you're making fun of me,
right?
Which is entirely possible.
Just riffing the movies like MST3K.
Yeah, we had a offer early on from a major distributor to basically do that. They wanted to distribute our movies, and they wanted to rip them. They wanted to, like, give them to these guys to, like, kind of like parody and riff on. Clear. Anyway,
no, see that if you'd only accept that if we were the ones doing the riffing.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
It doesn't quite work though, because it's like
we'll mock ourselves.
It's kind of a betrayal. Yeah, it's kind of a betrayal of trust too. I feel like if like we get witnesses or something to talk to us, and then we turn around and put them on.
Right.
So anyway, this is not a show about Small Town Monsters movies necessarily, but Mark and I are both members of STM. So that's why we call it the official podcast of Small Town Monsters. Also, it records directly in the STM production offices. So that is the reason. I'm going to mention this, and I'm going to mention it all month. So if you're one of those people who you used to listen to us on Saswa and it drove you crazy when we talked about anything relating to STM, you probably just find another show to listen to. We launched the next STM Kickstarter, Small Town Monsters Kickstarter, on February 7th. As we do every year, Mark and I are going to be part of the live Q&A on the 7th. So if you're on Facebook, if you follow Small Town Monsters or Monsteropolis on Facebook, tune in on February 7th at 7 o'clock, probably a little before 7 o'clock, because I think we'd like to be live when we launch the Kickstarter. But follow us on Facebook and you'll be able to tune into the live show, which is basically, like, I don't think it's anything like this, but it's Mark and I and some of the other crew folk, and we kick around conversational ideas and talk about things while the Kickstarter is live. And we always have a blast watching the Kickstarter sort of blow up or whatever. So
I think we should approximate the very first one that we did. So you'll have to set the thermostat in here to about 85.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I forgot all about that. We were in a tiny radio studio in downtown Wadsworth, and it was actually that room probably wasn't that much smaller than this room that we're in right now, but there were a lot of us in there.
Yeah.
Like probably eight of us in there, or eight of us in there, and it was, yeah, it was like 80 degrees.
There's a digital thermometer we watched continue to climb just throughout the whole
experience. Yeah, and it was February, so it was cold. Let's maybe get on topic. This week, we are talking about airships or old-timey UFOs, as I had written it. Old-timey UFOs.
I prefer that as a moniker, actually. Old-timey UFOs, which kind of sets up a month of unidentified flying object themed shows.
Yes. We're gonna wreck it with the final show, but
yeah,
there are three shows in a row that are UFO themed. And honestly, we're gonna get to a point where there's a lot of UFO talk on this show. It's something I've never really got. We didn't talk much about UFOs on Sasquatch, and it actually is one of my favorite para topics. I don't know about you, but it always has been. And I was into UFOs even before I was in Bigfoot. So of the two, I'd almost go with UFOs as the subject I kind of follow more closely.
You had a show called Flying Saucer Cast. Is that correct?
What was that? Oh, yeah. I did. I used to do a show called The Flying Saucer Cast. It had nothing to do with flying saucers or UFOs. It was a buddy and I, we talked about comic books on that show.
I see.
I think we did 8 episodes, and that was before ancillary characters. We're now almost 10 minutes into the show without addressing the topic, which is airships.
That's a great name, though.
It is. Well,
My
blog was Seth versus the Flying Saucers, and we were hosting it off my blog, so we called it the Flying Saucer Cast, even though it had nothing to do with flying saucers. I don't even know where to begin with this subject. So I'm just going to jump right in. I was very excited to talk about this because of the fact that I've always been very interested in the Aurora, Texas UFO crash. For listeners who might not know, in 1897, a strange football-shaped or cigar-shaped object supposedly crash-landed near the town of Aurora, Texas. Many of the townspeople showed up and found a dying alien laying outside the craft. They read his rights or whatever. Not they arrested him on the spot. Poor guy, man. Imagine he gets in an accident, another planet before he knows it, he's in jail. No, they prayed over him and all that, and he passed away tragically and was buried in the Aurora Cemetery. And that story is one of those, like, this was going to be in the SDM case book, right? So like, this is a story I've always loved. And today I woke up and I realized I hadn't done any research for this episode yet. So I watched a Jim Mars documentary. Are you aware of this?
No.
Okay. It's
what's
very,
it called?
I think Aurora Alien Crash of 1897, I think. And it's like kind of like a Minerva Monster type of thing. Like, you can tell they made it on like camcorders. It's not like terribly well edited. And it's pretty much just Jim Mars talking to the camera, except they do bring in some locals, which I actually thought was really cool. Like, some of these people they interviewed had family that were like there that night, and the story had been passed down generation to generation, which I thought was really cool. So I say things like this and then I forget about it, but I might try to like edit in some of the sound clips from that documentary or something. Cause it was a very, it was a very informative documentary. Jim Mars is like 100% whatever was going on that day was like an alien. It had to be an alien. But so anyway, the thing with that story, and chime in at any point, because I don't know how much research you've done on this, but like supposedly that night the airship streaks across the sky, slams into a windmill and crashes to the ground. The alien's found and then is buried in the cemetery. Jim Mars and another investigator found a very odd headstone. Jump back before I get to that, actually. So when this was reported in 1897, it was reported twice. There was the initial newspaper article that ran, UFO, it wasn't called a UFO, but strange airship crashes. The local constable said he believed the man that had died was from Mars. And they said that they had found papers on him that might detail his reason for traveling or something like that, which I thought was interesting. He was buried. I forget how this all went, but I feel like he was put in a metal box and buried very small, by the way. This man was a very small little alien gray type thing, buried in the cemetery. And then years pass. And in 1973, a newspaper reporter from somewhere in Texas finds that story and kind of uncovers it and does a write-up on it. And that's how Jim Mars gets turned onto this story. Mars begins investigating the Martian, and he actually finds a grave in the cemetery in Aurora that seems to match up with what was mentioned. The second newspaper article that ran in 1897 was just a blurb that detailed the fact that they had buried the Martian in the cemetery in an unmarked grave, except for an etching of like his craft on the tombstone. So they find what appears to be a headstone, very small grave. They could tell that because of where it was and the proximity to other graves. And they try to get the body exhumed. They are denied the right to exhume the body. And I don't know the passage of time here between them filing to have it exhumed or, you know, to check the grave and when this happens, but they basically show up one day and someone else has exhumed the grave and there's nothing in it now. So from there, this story became kind of like a part of UFO lore. It was covered on UFO Hunters in a really interesting episode, actually, where they found what they believe was like where the windmill would have been. Because basically what happened is there was a lot of like attempts at debunking the story. And there was a lady, a local historian, who had attempted to debunk it by claiming there was no windmill. But they've pretty much proven that there was a windmill in the spot where this supposedly happened. But anyway, the story kind of passed into UFO lore. And one of the things that Jim Mars uncovered when he was investigating this story is that this story was one part of a massive wave of phantom airships sightings that started in 1896 and went through 1897. And it's called the airship wave of, or the airship flap of 1896-97.
Yeah, that's what I had heard. My impression was that the town was kind of proprietary about the grave. I mean, they didn't want outsiders coming in, asking too many questions. So that's fascinating to me about the exhumation. And
well, I wonder if they did that then just to double check for themselves.
Maybe, because it really seemed, in what I had seen, I just got that impression that they really... I don't know. They emerged with this sense of respect for this being, whoever or whatever it was, and they took great lengths to keep the, you know, prying eyes from trying to get their hands on it. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite. It probably has become one of my favorite top three or four like UFO stories because of the fact that there is this small town involved and it's old timey. And you kind of picture a small Texas town with a alien visitor laying on the ground that they, you know, bury in this unmarked grave, except for I mean, Jim Mars in this episode, I don't even know if the headstone's still there today, but Mars, when this documentary was shot, and I really recommend, if people want to learn about the story, go watch this short, it's like 45 minutes long, and it's on YouTube. But anyway, when they found the grave, you know, like it had, an etching of what appeared to be like a football shaped object, three holes on it, you know, like portholes mm-hmm. or whatever. And the other thing about it, so I was planning on doing all this like UFO airship research for this episode, pulling up my newspaper's account and just like going to town today before you got here. And I didn't get to it. But, one thing I can say about this story, if you look at like some of the fake, Bigfoot stories we find, or like any kind of like the giant pythons or any of that stuff, you don't necessarily have. This is a very mundane account of an extraordinary circumstance. Like, it's a crash. It's an alien crash, but it's really talked about in the most mundane way possible. This is not what I would look at and think this is some sort of attempt at getting more newspapers bought or sold or whatever. Like, it really just seems like a retelling of events. And the part where they just give this little blurb about the burial of the creature is really interesting, because it's just like, was buried the next day in this cemetery, and then the story moves on, and the fact that so many townspeople have stories about like their great-grandpa telling them that they were there that night and things like that. Yes, that could just be kind of a, you know, like I guess a, you know, like in a way you could maybe look at that as this is just a local folktale that's being passed down or something like that. But it almost rings to me like history, like actual history. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that I believe that was an alien that crashed there that night or any of that stuff, but like, it's a very intriguing story that we'll never know. You're never going to know the answer to this. What's actually in that grave.
Right. Well, the fact that it's somehow understated, I think, is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there was this huge wave, and there was. I mean, I have a couple examples of that that come out of these papers from 1897. This was April 25th in the Daily Texarkanian, mm-hmm. which says, Judge Lawrence A. Byrne was known here for his truthfulness by his fellow men. And so this was his story, published on April 25th. I was down on McKinney Bayou Friday after the surveying of a tract of land, and in passing through a thicket to an open space, saw a strange-looking object anchored to the ground. On approaching it, I found it to be the airship I have read so much about of late. It was manned by three men who spoke a foreign language, but judging from their looks would take them to be Japanese. They saw my astonishment and beckoned me to follow them, and on complying, I was shown through the ship. Now, as weird as that sounds, that's hardly the only case that's reported in this paper wave of ones where the ship is like stationary on the ground and people are invited to come aboard and take a tour, and even in some cases have something to eat. So it's goes in bizarre directions very quickly.
It's really weird. The one I heard was the San Francisco, mm-hmm. Where you've got two men when they look, passersby or whatever, notice this strange object in the sky. They look up, they see what appears to be like two men pedaling,
yes.
sitting on basically like seats underneath the glowing object, but attached to it, which sounds very steampunk, like they're like propelling it by pedaling or whatever, and
giant wings that are flapping,
and this kind of and that's that sort of description is much more in line with this UFO wave than what you would consider today to be a UFO. It's very mm-hmm. steampunk UFO.
Yeah. For whatever reason, a lot of times when these airship pilots are spotted, they have beards or goatees, and that is consistent enough to be, you know, worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. There's another one from Belle Plains, Iowa, April 16th, again 1897. The citizens of Lynn Grove declare there's no longer any doubt among them of the existence of an airship. Yesterday morning, a large object was seen slowly moving in the heavens in a northerly direction and seemed to be making preparations to alight. It lists off a bunch of everyday people here, harness dealers, stock dealers. They jump into a rig, started in pursuit. They found the airship had alighted 4 miles north of town, and within 700 yards, it spread its four monstrous wings and flew off towards the north. The occupants threw out two large boulders of unknown composition, which were taken to the village and are now on exhibition. There were two queer-looking persons on board who made desperate attempts to conceal themselves. Evans and Krosky say they had the longest whiskers they ever saw in their lives. Nearly every citizen in Lynn Grove saw the airship as it sailed over the town, and the excitement is intense.
So the other thing, because these are going, these are all kind of taking place one after the next, so I'm going to run through a few here real quick, because I've got them. I don't have the entire articles, but I'm going to run down some of mine. On April 13th, 1897, in Denton, a man stargazing with a pair of powerful field glasses spots a dark object against the moon. At first, he assumes it's a meteor that had not yet hit Earth's atmosphere, but then realizes it was moving much too slowly. He described the object as being about 50 feet long, cigar-shaped, which comes up constantly, with two large mugs sticking out from either side, a beak, like a ship's cutwater at the front, and a large rudder or steering sail at the rear. Where the beak joined the main body of the object, there was a light that paled the moon in its brilliance. Along the body of the thing, there were more lights, which he assumed meant windows. No smoke was visible from the object. It moved slowly in a southeasterly direction for about 20 minutes, then accelerated to terrific speed and vanished from sight. That part's really weird, because up to then, you're thinking, okay, it's probably a... It could be like someone in a dirigible or, you know, like experimental, whatever. The sighting was confirmed by a lady in Denton. This is why I think these are so interesting, is because you don't just have one eyewitness. And that's if you're believing or taking these articles at face value. Mm-hmm. You don't just have like one or two witnesses. You have multiple witnesses and they seem to come up. The lady in Denton who... No field gas has described a very similar object moving in the same direction at slow speed, then suddenly accelerating. Both individuals were apparently well known to the editor of the newspaper, which published their accounts. He described as reputable persons whose reputation for truthfulness cannot be assailed. Two nights later, on April 15th, attorney J. Spence Bounds of Hillsborough was returning from Osceola in the southwestern part of Hill County after having been called out to write an emergency will for a dying Hill County pioneer. At about an emergency will, that's the worst. Get out here immediately. I've got to leave this horse to somebody. at about 9 p.m., he stated he and his horse were frightened by a brilliant flash from an electric searchlight which passed directly over my buggy. He described the object which the searchlight was attached as in shape something like a cigar. Beneath it, he described something similar to a ship which was attached to the cigar-shaped object. He witnessed the thing disappear behind a hill near the town of Aquila, a little southwest of Hillsborough. Later that night, Patrick Burns, a telegraph repairman for the TNP Railroad, was working near Putnam Station east of Cisco, repairing broken lines when clouds covered the moon and he could no longer see to work. He got on his bicycle and headed for Cisco. As he passed the Del Mar siding about 5 miles from Cisco, he saw a brilliant light in a field to the side of the tracks. He decided to investigate. Burns not only saw the mysterious object up close, he got to talk to the presumptive captain of the flight crew. According to Burns, the craft was about 200 feet long by 50 feet wide. It had a snail shell like appendage at the nose and tail. no description on this of what that guy looked like. Oh, there's the picture of the cemetery.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the photo.
Pretty distinctive.
Of the the photo of the... the gravestone from Aurora was, this is taken 2012, so I'm thinking it's still there.
That would be so cool to see.
We need to go.
Yeah, that's the one fascinating feature of a lot of these reports is interaction between eyewitnesses and the pilots. And the pilots are often described with some sort of, I mean, they're human. I mean, it seems like very rarely are the occupants described as alien as much as the Aurora case is. Yeah. A lot more, it's just like someone from like Eastern Europe or Northern Europe and dressed very strangely, distinctively, but a human being that they can easily interact with and speak to.
And the craft descriptions are similar, but not identical. Mm-hmm. Like there's, I don't know that I saw any that were just perfectly identical in description. And there's always like a weird detail here or there that kind of stands out. I don't know if you noticed that, but like, mm-hmm. like the two guys pedaling underneath the one. Mm-hmm. A lot of the descriptions sound like a blimp, because you're talking about a giant sort of object, and then with a smaller object underneath attached mm-hmm. to it, like a ship attached to it, is how a lot of people would talk about it. I don't know when dirigibles started being introduced or when they started being used. I would assume at this point in history that was a thing.
Yeah, I looked at that, and again, I don't have it in front of me, but my impression is that they started to be used widely a little bit after these reports to surface. It gives you the impression that these were some kind of test.
Experiments,
yeah. Yeah, it's very weird.
They're seen, by the way, we're talking about this as a wave without mentioning. They were seen essentially coast to coast. Mm-hmm. There were sightings in Ohio, but the first one I talked about was San Francisco. And in some cases, it seems to be a pattern where you literally contract the sightings across the country in a certain direction, where you have a report one day in a town and then the next day in the next town and things like that. Like the sightings were taking place all across the country. 1896 to 1897, the mystery airship wave.
Yeah. Another feature that I find very, I don't know, it's distinctive, is you've got case after case where people are named and they're a lot of times in law enforcement. So it would seem as if you could, back then, you could have tracked those people down mm-hmm. if you so desired. And then there's the element of them signing an affidavit, testifying to that what they had seen. You know, almost always you have this little passage in these stories that either they'd sign an affidavit or this person was known in the community and their word was beyond reproach. You know, just inviting the reader to interpret this as a real story. And I don't know if that's folkloric in a sense that you have to have these certain elements present in the story, or if they're there because, you know, they really did go and sign off on their story. But this one I thought was kind of interesting because it's got a lot of these same elements. It's two lawmen, Constable Sumpter and Deputy Sheriff McLemore of Garland County, Arkansas, May 8th, 1897. I'll summarize some of this. They chase these lights for a while, and finally, they rode on about a half mile further. They saw the lights, start to come down towards a field. About 100 yards distant, we saw two persons moving around with lights. Drawing our Winchesters, for we were now thoroughly aroused to the importance of the situation, we demanded, "Who is that, and what are you doing?" A man with a long, dark beard came forth with a lantern in his hand, and on being informed who we were, proceeded to tell us that he and the others, a young man and a woman, were traveling through the country in an airship. We could plainly distinguish the outlines of the vessel, which was cigar-shaped and about 60 feet long, and looking just like the cuts that have appeared in the papers recently. It was dark and raining, and the young man was filling a big sack with water about 30 yards away, and the woman was particular to keep back in the dark. She was holding an umbrella over her head. The man with the whiskers invited us to take a ride, saying that he could take us where it was not raining. We told him we preferred to get wet. Asking the man why the brilliant light was turned on and off so much, he replied that the light was so powerful that it consumed a great deal of his motive power. He said he would like to stop off in Hot Springs for a few days and take the hot baths, but his time was limited and he could not. He said they were going to wind up at Nashville, Tennessee, after thoroughly seeing the country.
Being in a hurry, we left, and upon our return, about 40 minutes later, nothing was to be seen. We did not hear or see the airship when it departed. Signed, John J. Sumpter, Jr. and John McLemore. Subscribed and sworn to me on the day, 8th of May, May 1897. So,
I mean, if you're going to make up a story too, if dirigibles really weren't fit for public consumption at this point, I don't know how you want to word that, but like these are all very similar in description to that. Now the Aurora craft isn't like Mars kind of like sandwiches that in with all the other mystery airship reports, but there aren't many of these reports of what we think of as kind of a classic UFO, and the Aurora craft and description, and even the creature the alien description is similar to what we now consider like typical UFO lore. It stands apart from a lot of this mystery airship stuff. Maybe that's why I like the Aurora guy so much.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It does seem to be, two separate streams of events taking place there for sure. And ahead of its time in a way, the Aurora. So the thing that's cool is that John Keel was actually...
Naturally, here we go.
...very interested in the airship and has a whole chapter in his book Operation Trojan Horse on the 1897 flap. And sort of his, you know, he compiles, and this is interestingly based a lot on the work of people like Jacques Vallée and others who really dug into the patterns behind these cases. And, you know, he says, let's see. In 1897, when people saw actual objects, they described them as being cigar-shaped, or being large dark forms with lights attached. No flying saucers turned up in the reports I have collected, but the nighttime observations then were exactly the same as they are now. Bright lights with colored lights flashing around them, often moving in erratic fashion, but apparently controlled. It is possible that the airship was nothing more than a decoy, a cover for the real activity that was taking place in 1897. Certainly these objects did not consist of one or two clumsy balloons shuffling across the country. You know, typical Keel style there, but, you know, he, well, you know, if you've read Keel, you know that he loves to just throw things out there, not even as things that he's necessarily suggesting as the explanation to everything, but saying, if A is true, then B could be equally as true, because it's all sort of crazy and nonsensical. So the idea that... the airships or the balloons could somehow be a decoy for quote unquote actual UFO activity. It's the classic explaining one anomaly with another, but it's fascinating to consider that would be some sort of odd cover up or misdirection on the part of whatever those out.
What is the argument against these just being like typical test aircraft by like people just experimenting with aircraft? Because people like Jim Mars pushed this as very clearly like some sort of extraterrestrial wave or flap that took place. Why don't they go with the more common mundane sort of explanation?
I don't know. That's an excellent question. I would imagine that it's just not as fantastic.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these interactions, I mean, people are speaking English, number one. Mm-hmm. There's a back and forth communication. People are not seeing aliens stepping off. They're seeing women with umbrellas and guys, you know, filling up jugs of water. And in one case, there's a cook aboard who is making pancakes and gives the guy a pancake.
Oh, man. That's perfect.
See, and that's the other thing, too. I guess he took the pancake, sampled it a little bit, but then it got put on display in town, like that other report that I read.
The pancake?
The pancake. I don't know if they put it under glass or whatever, or just enamel. Put it on a plate.
They covered it in enamel and
come see
the alien
mystery pancake.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
But like these other that other report where they dropped boulder like objects out and then went on display in town. That seemed to be another consistent feature of the story, is like something was left behind by the pilots of these crafts and became sort of took a place of pride in that community. Like, hey, we were part of this little flap, and almost a little museum piece was then created, which extends into the future, like into the 1960s and so forth. That just made me think of a very famous case where a light came towards a car and there was an accident. And long story short, that car was put in a local museum as an example of a close encounter of the second kind.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is that a case that I know about? What?
Well, we'll get into that in the Project Blue Book episode. No.
Hang tight, guys.
A little hook there. Right. But yeah. Yeah, I think it probably is. It's one of the prominent cases of the 60s and 70s.
Wrap us up on airships.
Airships, I think it's just here's a weird word to use, but they're sort of a lovely description of a strange phenomena and one that certainly is a case. This is a perfect example of how this phenomena, whatever it must be, mirrors the tastes and the known quantities of the current era. I think the idea of the airship, you know, the lighter than aircraft on which, you know, you can sort of tool about the country and end up in Nashville and your trip is done. It sort of, to me, sort of fits the whims and the whimsy of that era where you know, there was a certain amount of prosperity, and if you were well enough to do, maybe that was the sort of thing that you could get away with, is this little jaunt in an airship if you knew the right people.
It is also interesting, though, that like the way UFOs change, the descriptions seem to match up with technologically either where we're at or where we're going to be very soon. Because you've got like the 1940s and 50s UFO description sounds very much like what you would expect a UFO description in the 1940s and 50s to be. You know, it's just like craft you can actually see the rivets on and like things like that. You know, these flying saucer kind of classic description. And now it's all like triangular UFOs in the sky and strange lights and like there's something to be said about that too.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.